Hey, everybody. Welcome to How Success Happens. I'm Dan Bova from Entrepreneur.com. And today we have three co-authors of the new book, Extreme Balance, Paradoxical Principles That Make You a Champion. Our authors are Joe DeSena, who is the founder and CEO of the global endurance sports brand Spartan Race. Ben Askren is the co-founder of Askren Wrestling Academy. He was a member of the 2008 U.S. Olympic wrestling team. He's a two-time NCAA national champion. If you're watching this on video, you can tell he's in a little bit better shape than I am. And David Sachs is a licensed clinical psychologist and consultant for athletes and other elite performers. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Yep. Great to see you. And I'm hoping over the course of this conversation, you will transform this soft, doughy podcaster into an elite performer. So ready, go. So why don't we talk a little bit? I mean, I love this title, Extreme Balance. It, as you say, quite paradoxical. I wonder, Joe, do you want to jump in and kind of explain what the title means and how you guys kind of got together to write this book?
Yeah, Ben and I had bumped into each other. We're pretty involved on the Spartan side in wrestling, oddly enough, probably because it is the original sport, right? And lots of wrestlers back in ancient Sparta. So we bumped into each other. I don't remember where. Maybe at the NCAA.
We were doing a podcast.
Oh, we were in a podcast. We're in a podcast together, and then we spoke. And I think you said you had this really great idea for a book. And I said, let's hear it. And you started, spitting it out. And I said, that is a great idea. I think our audience would love it. You said you thought your audience would love it. And so, I don't know, it's been at least 3 years in the making, this thing. Probably another 6 or 7 years in your head before that. So this is a decade long journey. Thank God we met David Sachs, who, took out the old fashioned feather pen and started helping us write this thing.
Yeah. So I had the idea. The idea in my head originally was hypocritical, right? So meaning you have two thoughts that are in opposition to each other and you can hold them both to be true in your head. And, as we started writing, I don't know whose suggestion it was, but, it came up that it's a balance between these mindsets. And a lot of people fail to balance the mindsets. And somehow we came down to Extreme Balance, which I think is a great name for the book. Much better sounding than my original titles. David was amazing. He added so much thought process through the book. And I'm really, really happy with how it came out.
So, one of the lines, I read the book. I loved it. I love just this concept because – so much of what we hear is, all about these extremes, either pushing yourself to the limit and beyond always, or like not doing that and listening to your body and taking the time you need and all that. Yes. And it's always these extremes. But I love how you guys have sort of, come to what feels like common sense as you're reading it. It really like strikes you as like, of course I could be really tired, but really excited at the same time.
So Dan, as I kind of perused all the sports psychology books that were out there for athletics prior to this, it was always, you need this, you need this, you need this. And what I noticed as I started coaching athletes is they really struggled putting those pieces together. Cause when someone says you need to push through injury and be really, really tough, they're like, okay, I can do that. But then when you also need to say, well, hey, dummy, if you keep going, it's going to hurt you worse.
Yeah.
But wait, I thought you told me to be tough and push through it.
Right.
And the thing is, they're both true at times, right? There's times you're going to absolutely need to push through. And there's times where you probably need to say, hey, I'm going to take a couple days off because if I don't, I'm going to be hurt significantly worse and it's going to have a hugely negative impact on my career. And people struggle to balance that the extreme balance of both of these thought processes and hold them both to be true at the same time.
There's let me just jump in for a second. I was in ancient Sparta. We put on a race there, and I was with the preeminent professor of Sparta, and he was giving me his rundown on some great stories from back then. And one of the stories goes that there was a city state that was in trouble, and they ran to Sparta, as they often did, for help. And the Spartans said, "We can't. We're in the middle of our festivities week." And I couldn't reconcile that in my head. Like, the ancient Spartans would have a festivities week? They had no time off. All they did was train morning till night. So I love the way Ben just described it, right? Because you do have to be able to balance those two. And it's not easy.
That's great. So, David, you work with, elite athletes, high performers. I mean, part of what Ben is describing, yeah, sometimes it's someone telling you to push through it, but a lot of people are pushing themselves through it. So how do you work with athletes or any kind of high performer to kind of let them know that it's okay to, when they have to take a break?
Yeah, it's a great question. What I'll lead with is what the barriers are to that. And something we talk about in the book is when someone holds a value kind of closely, they feel like any violation of that value is becoming the opposite of what they stand for. Mm-hmm. And that's what prevents somebody who may be super committed to being mentally tough. That's what makes it hard for them. Even if their coach is telling them or their boss is telling them, "Hey, take a day off, take it easy."
Yeah.
They're going to feel the opposite of tough. They're going to feel like they're a total wimp.
Right.
And so a lot of the work we do is, again, paradoxically, being confident enough in yourself that you know how to be tough. So that's not at risk for you taking a day off or resting your knee for an injury. And a lot of what happens in a therapy or consultation session is working on that part, the fear of becoming the opposite, which we call in the book a non-slippery slope, that you can actually go on that slope and not fall dramatically to the opposite side.
Yeah, let me build on that, because I was thinking about this yesterday, about some of these different chapters. You know, so chapter 7 is thinking you're good enough and thinking you're never good enough. Mm. And so, to the point, if I'm coaching an athlete and they lack the confidence to even go try something, they're never going to get there. So I want an athlete that's super confident. But then once they go too far, then you get to the point where they think they know everything and they won't listen to you. And that's not good either, right? So when they're walking out to a match, I don't want them thinking, "Oh my God, I have 27 questions to ask my coach." I want them thinking, "I have trained hard. I am going to compete as hard as I can, and I'm going to do my best," and not concerned about all the things they don't know. But then they go to the competition and they come back on Monday. I want them to say, "Hey, coach, I struggled on finishing a single leg and getting off bottom," and ask questions. So it's like you can hold both of these things to be true at the same time, but a lot of people struggle with that, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of kids usually have one or the other. If they have neither, they probably stink, right? And they're probably just like, just started. But a lot of kids are one or the other. And it, to be really, really elite, I think you need both.
But by the way, Ben, this is applicable to not just sports. This is absolutely business. This is family life. This is your whole life these principles apply to.
Absolutely. And building off that, Joe, I wanted to ask, so much in entrepreneurship, you know, we talk about passion and having this singular vision and this drive. And I'm wondering if you guys could talk a little bit about, you know, the difference between, or how do you know the difference between the good kind of tunnel vision versus the being stubborn and unwilling to adapt and unwilling to hear other thoughts kind of tunnel vision, which maybe isn't so productive?
Sure. I would say that, you know, one of the things that when we did the first version of the book, I read through it and I said, "David, I think this is too hard. I think this is going to be too hard for people." And I'm like, "Well, do we dumb it down and make it easier?" Because that's kind of what a lot of people want. They don't want to think like on every single thing that, "Oh, I could be this or this or this." They don't want to take that deep thought and think through it, right? A lot of people want a simple formula. And I said, but we need to be true to what we're doing And being great at something is hard. It's really, really, really hard. And so when you're talking about, you know, that tunnel vision, you know, that would be, that would remind me of chapter six, focusing on the process and focusing on the outcome. Mm. Right. And so if you focus on the process, you're gonna do the great things day to day, but unless you're somewhat focused on the outcome, you don't know where you're going. You don't know what you're trying to build or what you're trying to do or anything. So it's like, you have to have a vision of what the outcome is going to be. And hey, it may change once in a while, right? But you also got to be focused on the process of the day-to-day things that you're doing to help your business be great.
We had this battle today in our business where I'm, as an owner, I'm very focused on the long term. Right? But at the same time, we need to hit our numbers today. And we're asking the people that work for us to have KPIs and focus around the numbers today. And it's very hard to reconcile that. But what, you know, what Dave and Ben put together here at least gets you thinking when you're going through what I was going through today that, hey, I've got to balance both of these extremes and make this work.
So what, you know, in finding Joe in, you know, your example that you just gave, but also, I mean, the three of you are obviously high performers have had to find balance. And finding balance isn't easy. And I'm wondering if you could all talk about, like, what's been your biggest personal challenge in finding balance, and if there was some kind of breakthrough moment or breakthrough thought that kind of leads you when you are in a situation like you just described, Joe, where you're feeling like kind of trapped between two things.
I'm the worst one to ask because I'm the least balanced person amongst.
I know mine right away. I can tell you mine. And the one I'm going to tell you is also kind of the one, not this specific situation, but it was a similar situation years later that would lead me to start thinking down this path. But there's a lot of people who are very good at preparing for something, but when they prepare for something, either if something goes wrong or they build up anxiety around the outcome, and you know, especially in sports, but it could be in big business meetings, but you clam up and you don't perform like you should. Mm. And I remember I always loved training hard and I always loved working hard. And I had this, it was called Fargo. It's the cadet 16U Nationals. My first time there, and I crapped the bed. I lost both my matches and neither one of them were close. And I wasn't great, but I absolutely wasn't that bad. I wasn't even close to that bad. You know, I performed significantly below my skill level. And one of my coaches at that time, he grabbed me and said, "Hey man, I know you're better than this." And this was a problem that I struggled with, is when you become too obsessive on something and you're trying to go through the myriad of possibilities that could happen, you wear yourself out mentally, you get really tight, you get too anxious, and then you perform like crap.
Right.
And he said, this needs to be a focus for you, is if you recognize yourself, and now I've recognized this in many other kids now as I've coached, right? If you're this obsessive personality, you also have to be able to let go. Right? You have to be able to let go of the anxiety and all the things that can happen. You just got to be able to just go out there and compete. And so that became a really big focus. And then really after that point, so I was like, you know, like maybe 16 years old or somewhere in there, I actually feel like I became a really elite performer. So, So not just I was elite at the skill level, but I became elite at executing the skill level when it mattered the most.
The entrepreneurial adaptation of what Ben just described, I would say, When you're going to start a business, there's a personality, which is not me, that will do 15 business plans, iterate on it, 45 advisors, yeah. Go raise, like, and do all this work, but never actually pull the trigger.
Right.
Right? Right. Versus me, no planning, no business plan, fire, ready, aim, and right. I'll figure it out on the way.
Right.
Yeah. And I'll say, related to that, what both of you folks are talking about is you care about something deeply, so you pump a lot of effort and energy into it because you care so much and you want it to go well. But one thing that happens a lot is like that effort that you've put into it becomes almost like an albatross around your neck, that you feel like now you're beholden to your past self because you put all this effort and energy, and it would all be wasted if you don't go out there and perform. which then causes you to tighten up. And so this, there's another chapter of the book titled Care Deeply and Keep It in Perspective. And like, that's one of those times where if you're a person that struggles with performance anxiety, then that when the performance is upon you is a time to keep it in perspective and say, I'm proud of myself because of the way I prepared. That's what I have the most control about. And then I can let go and let it fly.
Well, I love that. And Joe, you were one of our investors on the show, Entrepreneur Elevator Pitch. So you get to see people come in. They've got 60 seconds to pitch their business, to try to secure some funding. And so, you know, some people do great.
60 seconds. That's tough. That's a serious performance right
yeah,
there.
Yeah, yeah, right. So I wonder if the three of you could talk a little bit about that sort of like it's go time. Like I'm about to step onto the mat. I'm about to step into a boardroom, you know, whatever it might be. Things that you use personally, or David, things that you've found other athletes, you know, use to kind of calm themselves, but not calm themselves too much so that they're ready to go. Can you talk about that, like, go time moment?
I'll go first. And I'm really lucky. I have massive ADD.
Uh-huh.
And so if I'm going to give a speech, you know, 10,000 people, I should be nervous as hell. I take my mind somewhere else. I don't pay attention at all to what's coming up in the next 10 minutes. I'm not preparing. I'm not practicing. I don't overthink it. I just get on stage and start talking. And I feel in those few instances where I've tried to hone in, review notes, get really it does not turn out as well for me.
Yeah.
I remember Grant Cardone had me come out between the screens and people in the room. It was 20,000 people.
Wow.
I had like 4 seconds to even think, like right out on stage, and I was talking. And that's, for me, that's the way I like it. Yeah.
Now, are you, when you're talking, are you like floating above yourself, watching yourself talk, or are you like in it?
I'm in it, and I'm really in tune, probably like anybody speaking, to how the audience is reacting, and I'm looking for more of the positive react, right? Like, right. I'm in it. I'm in it, listening to myself, and just really in tune with the audience. As a matter of fact, that particular speech with that group, it was almost as if they were being paid to laugh and say exactly what I wanted to say on cue. It was surreal almost.
That's great.
But that's the flow state, right? That's when it's working.
Yeah, and I definitely want to ask you all about that too. But Ben, when you're competing or when you're training athletes, like what do you talk to them about? You know, in those final moments before the match starts.
Well, I think that the caring deeply and keeping in perspective is important, because if we do care too deeply and we build that performance anxiety, that can be negative. But then the other chapter I really thought about when you brought this question up, with chapter 9, is prepare for everything and expect the unexpected. And that's, you know, that's business too. I was talking to someone about business with this earlier. It's like, and kind of to what Joe said earlier, you can prepare all you want, but you're not going to get it perfect. There's going to be unexpected that happens. Mm-hmm. And that's a wrestling match. That's a fight. That's a speech. You know, like, something's going to happen and you got to be ready to switch and change it up. And, you know, I think where that comes from is understanding the subject matter deeply. And, you know, so if it's a wrestling match and I think, oh, I can use this strategy, and the wrestling match starts and, man, they're better than I expected in that. I have to be able to switch, right?
Right.
I can't stick with my initial plan, just like and you see this with people in business where they have, oh, I built this great plan and here's my projections. And then they start the business and it's obvious that it's not working, but they can't switch.
Yeah.
Right. It's like, well, but this is so obvious to see from 100 miles away that you need to switch your business plan because the one you had was not working, but they're too stubborn and they can't do it. So I think, you know, chapter 9 speaks a lot to that, you know, competitive in the moment type thing also.
David, do you have any Is there any blanket advice for that kind of go time moment, or is it all individualized?
Yeah. Well, I appreciate the way you asked the question, like, is there blanket advice? One thing we keep coming back to in the book is it's risky to seek that blanket advice.
Right.
And that's what everyone's craving. Tell me what I should do. That way I won't have to worry anymore.
Yeah.
That being said, there is a guideline that I often mention as a tool to help somebody if they simply are not at a spot at the moment where they can control their performance anxiety and they're just nervous about it. Then a suggestion is pick one thing or a couple of things specifically related to the task in front of you. If you're giving a presentation, perhaps that's making sure you speak in a cadence that works for you. If you're fielding questions, perhaps that is taking a moment to make sure you understand the question that's being asked, and that might mean repeat the question. So that can become, the risk there is it can become a little bit of a crutch, and right. It can become something that you focus too heavily on. But if somebody's like just unable to pull it together, then picking something like that that's relevant to the task, and especially something very basic for that person who's well prepared, that's not going to increase their anxiety at the moment. Generally stay task oriented under pressure.
We'll be right back after a few words from our sponsors. You know, one of the things that you wrote about was about practice and being deliberate in your practice. And you listed three things. You said training with a particular goal in mind, doing things that are not always fun, and receiving timely and accurate feedback. So I'd love to kind of dive into that a little bit and talk about it from the perspective of, you know, somebody trying to get in better shape or be better at a sport, but, you know, also for our audience trying to be better at being an entrepreneur or getting better ideas or leading better.
That's business advice. We just had a manager's meeting. So Aspen Wrestling Academy has 7 locations. And, you know, one of the things we were talking about this morning was this really boring, tedious part of the business. And it's like, yeah, it's not fun. It's not the part that any of us like, but if we're going to be really, really good at this, it's got to get done.
Yeah.
And for everything, there's that part. And we would love to do the fun parts, but this is, again, ideally you pick something that you enjoy, but that doesn't mean you're going to enjoy every single tiny little part of it. There's always going to be these little things. And the people who are great at what they do the little things too. They don't just do the things they like. They do all the things they need to do to achieve the really, really high level of success. So, yeah, we were having the meeting this morning. I think my brother literally said that almost exact line.
That's great. Joe, I know you love doing burpees, so that doesn't feel like work for you, right?
It's funny. I have a one of my best friends is wildly successful, you know, in the billions. And when I do the work I do, which is the burpees or – you know, going out to the races or whatever, he says, you're not doing the tough stuff. Like, you're not leaning into the things, like Ben just said, that you don't like. You don't like dealing with the CFO and going through the finances. You don't like HR. And he's right. And you do need to do those little things. I just listened to Ben say it. And obviously, I'm a co-author in the book, but that doesn't make me good at wanting to do. I hate that stuff. I hate it.
Yeah. I'll add that where I went to graduate school at Florida State and was very fortunate to interact with Anders Ericsson while I was there, who's largely considered the father of deliberate practice. And he really emphasizes that it's not simply putting the time in. You know, there are people that golf all their lives and never improve at it. And how could that be? It's because they're going through the motions or maybe, you know, having a good time at it. But deliberate practice, as you mentioned, is not inherently fun, largely because your best chance to improve is to work on the things that are your biggest weaknesses.
Right.
And as Ben points out, usually your biggest weaknesses are the things that you like the least. An example I'll tell about that is I previously worked at a medical school helping students that were having difficulty. And I don't know how many times folks would say, man, I just hate microbiology or I hate this anatomy. And I'm like, would tell them at risk of them thinking that I'm not being supportive, but giving them honest feedback. Like, if you hate microbiology or you hate physiology, like, I'm not sure I want to go see you as a doctor. You know? And so that thing that like you're trying to avoid is the thing that you ought to pay attention to. And therefore, it's not fun. But if you're driven to get better, you'll work on the things that you need the most improvement in.
Well, and going off of that, you know, one of the things that I really liked in the book, too, was the tough, smart mantra. You say you should aim to push your mind and body to the brink, but not beyond their breaking point. You know, we touched on this a little bit earlier, but wondering if you'd talk a little bit more about that in terms of, you know, how do you know your breaking point until you find it? And how do you recover from that? You know, especially on the mental side of all this stuff we've been talking about.
Hey, I was going to say, Ben, before you go, I spend a lot of time with the military folks, and I've asked this question myself a lot. And it really fascinates me that their job is to get all these recruits exactly to that point and then pull back and then go a little further the next time and then pull back. And it really is art. More than science. Ben probably deals with it every day in the room.
Yes. Yeah, that was the example I was going to bring up is, you know, I think the thing that a lot of wrestling coaches do wrong, and one of the reasons we've grown to 7 locations, which nobody else has, is they want to show kids right away how tough it is, and they want to try to, like, break them, right, as it's called. And sometimes they do, and then sometimes the kids never go back. And so, you know, first of all, in the beginning, we never ever try to really push them that hard. But when they get a little older and the kids decide, hey, this is what I want to be good at, I'm going to push them. And I kind of know how far they've gone because I've been with them. I'm going to push them farther than they've gone before, but I'm not going to make them quit. Right. And then once I know that they can go to that threshold, then the next time we'll go a little further. And the next time we'll go a little further. Right. And so it's not like go from, you know, say 20 minutes of work to 90 minutes of work. It's we're going to go to 30. Then we're going to go to 35, and then we're going to 40, and we're going to build them up over time. And I think that's a really, really sustainable way to do it. Once in a while, you'll get that kid who is just such a savage. They're just going to keep going, you know? So it's like you'll get some of those kids, but for the most part, I think it's just sustainably building them up over time.
Do you sleep on the mat, Ben?
I would like to think in my younger years, I absolutely outworked everyone in wrestling. But I have no quantifiable proof of that.
Is it against your nature to sleep on your back like you can't even be pinned while you're sleeping?
I can't sleep on my back. I don't think it has anything to do with getting pinned though. I always tell kids I don't ever let the high school kids pin me. I tell them I have this dysfunction where my two shoulders won't go down at the same time.
That's great.
That's awesome.
Something I'll add comes from two athletes that we were fortunate to interview for the book. Joe put us in touch with the Sinkovich brothers, who since the publication have won yet another Olympic gold medal in pairs rowing. And to the question, you know, in an endurance sport like that, of course you're going to be in pain and push yourself really hard. And we talked to them about, well, how do you balance that part out? And like anything else, it's through deliberate practice, knowing your body well enough to know when you're pushing past that point. They talked about earlier in their career, you know, they were perhaps so enthusiastic about helping out the team and making sure they won that they'd go out in the race a little bit too hard and burn out and then have an overall slower time.
Right.
And that's something that they had to actually work on through deliberate practice. We come back down to there's no easy answers.
Yeah.
And you can read our book will help you know what to consider. But, You know, whether someone actually maximizes the benefit out of it depends on what they use, what they do with it.
Yeah, so important. And, you know, actually, Ben, I want to go back to what you're saying a little bit about, you know, the sort of, let's just say, it's social media. You know, whether it's Elon Musk or maybe it's some guy I used to work with and he's posting on LinkedIn, but there's this comparison thing that is pretty hard to get over. And especially if you're looking at social media or something like LinkedIn, it's just person after person saying their accomplishments, and it makes you feel like, shit, what am I doing? I'm sitting on my couch reading all these other people's accomplishments. David, do you have any, besides delete all those apps from your phone, is there any like good way to sort of balance being inspired by people versus being feeling like less than or just feeling overwhelmed by them?
Man, David, we didn't do a chapter about that. That's a great chapter. Can we have one?
It is a great idea that it's a tough question to answer simply. I will say that I have clients from time to time say, I know I shouldn't do this, but I do compare myself to others. Then I have other clients say, or sometimes the same client say, I know it sounds really egotistical. I don't want to sound arrogant here, but I think I'm the best kid at my school at this, or I'm the best person on my block at this. So it'd be easy to say, delete all your apps, don't compare yourself to others. But then a lot of coaches talk about when you're running up stadium stairs, imagine your opponent running next to you, right. You know, and think about what they're doing. And there are times where even if you're competing against yourself in a sport like wrestling or any combat sport, like you need to have an opponent to compete against. You may be competing with yourself, but you're using your opponent as the gauge rather than like the clock as your gauge.
Right.
So like anything, like balancing that is an ongoing process. And I come down to what Ben said earlier. Are you somebody who has a generally low self-esteem? If so, it's probably a good idea to spend less time comparing yourself to others.
Right.
Are you somebody who thinks you're all that and people are frustrated with you because you're not getting feedback? Then it might be good to look at like, hey, you're not the only one who does this. There are better people out there than you are.
I will tell you, you know, we battled Tough Mudder. Tough Mudder was our main competitor for a decade. And I would not go on their website. I would not go to one of their papers. I was afraid, Ben, that I would subconsciously or consciously take some of their things, get upset about something. Like, I did not want to.
Joe, they might have had some good ideas that you could have used. You never know.
They might have had really good ideas, but the other side of it is they kept me awake at night. They kept me on my toes. They kept us expanding faster than was comfortable. I moved my family. Like, when I think about how fast the industry grew, it wouldn't have happened if I didn't have them nipping at our heels. Yeah. Nonstop. So was it right, to your point, Ben, was it right or wrong if I looked at their stuff, didn't look there? Just two ways of comparing yourself to somebody else. That they were wildly more successful in the beginning. They were smarter, they were younger, they had more money. Like, everything about them was better. In the end, we won. And I don't know if it's because I didn't look at their stuff. I don't know what we outworked. I don't know what it was, but competition was good and could be bad, to your point.
Yeah, I mean, so like I said, I think this would be a great chapter for the book because it's absolutely something you can balance. I think, you know, on the one hand, I tell my kids all the time, comparison is a thief of joy. We don't want to compare. Mm. But then on the other hand, I think like comparison is what drives human beings. You think of something like the 4-minute mile, and once it was broken, then other people knew, hey, this could be done. And I've seen that in my own academy. Once the first kid wins Fargo or something, then all of a sudden, boom, floodgates open. We can go do it, you know, first kid wins the title. Now we have 3 or 4 of them, you know? So once they see it, then they know they can do it. It acts as an inspiration to them. You know, and then to counter Joe's point about not looking at that Tough Mudder website, like one of the things that I would always do in wrestling is I would always watch the very best people and think, what are they doing and what can I steal?
Right.
What moves are they doing right now that I don't know or I'm not implementing? and how can I steal them? And when I was innovating on folk style technique, absolutely, because it'd be like you'd pull this one little thing here and this one little thing here, and then you put them together, and then all of a sudden you got magic, you know?
Yeah.
So I was absolutely saying, where can I get the best ideas, and how do I go find them? So I'd watch the best wrestlers and see what I could take from them. But I do think it's a balance, because yes, when people endlessly compare themselves, then generally that leads to, you know, low self-esteem, negative thoughts, et cetera, et cetera. So another chapter. Hey, when we do the follow-up, David, we're nailing this one.
All right, there you got it.
This is going to be a supplemental chapter. We could just sell the paper. Actually, we could put it online.
Yeah. There you go. I love it.
So for everyone who's listening and watching, the book is called Extreme Balance. And when you're listening to this, this means the book is out, and we're actually offering a 25% off discount code. The code is EXTREME. If you go to entrepreneur.com/bookstore, you could find it right there. So guys, in the lead up to this, we asked our readers if they had any questions. We got a bunch of great ones, but we'll keep it to two. So if you're ready for some reader questions, here we go.
Fire.
You know, it's funny. People always say, prepare for the unexpected. But how are you supposed to do that if you don't actually know what's coming?
Yeah. So, I mean, prepare for the unexpected is, I actually don't think you can, right? It's unexpected. That's literally the definition of the word. So you prepare for everything that you can, and something may come up, right? And so like if it's in business and you're a well-rounded business person, something comes up and you say, oh, what can I use to figure this out? Right. And listen, I'm more adept in wrestling. So like when a new technique comes out, it's like, okay, what do we know that's similar to that? Like what tools can we go? And I, you know, in my mind, I scroll through all the tools that I have. What is the solution to this puzzle?
Mm.
And so it's like something comes up, and you know, where someone would fail, and I listened to this earlier, it's like something unexpected comes up and they want to keep just acting like it doesn't exist and doing what they've always done. But it's like, no, this is here now. We didn't expect it, but it's here, and right. We need to figure out how to deal with it. And so that's kind of like, I think it's, if it's unexpected, no, you can't prepare for it. But when it does pop up, you ideally have a whole bunch of different weapons to try to throw at it that's going to solve the new puzzle.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
I have something to add to that, and that is you can prepare with adopting a particular attitude. Going into something that has some uncertainty around it, rather than think I'm going to control this thing and make it go the way I want, to adopt a mindset of like, I'm doing an experiment here, or I'm going on an adventure here, and actually relish that rather than perceive the uncertainty and the ambiguity as a source of stress, to view it as a source of excitement. The way that, you know, if you are watching a movie that you've seen 100 times, it's going to be less thrilling than when you don't know what's going to happen. And going into an uncertain situation like that is a way to mentally prepare.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. That's great.
Yeah. My buddy, Gerald Meerschaert, he has the UFC middleweight record for submissions. I want to say he's like second or third all time of anyone who's ever fought in the UFC. He tells this amazing story in the book about how, you know, in the early days of low-level mixed martial arts, he's like, I was warming up in kitchens and closets and all this stuff. And he said, you know, that really helped me, because the first fight I had in the UFC, the TV time was running behind schedule. And so instead of being able to warm up in the locker room, he said they walked him out next to the cage and he's literally warming up in front of the crowd.
Oh, wow.
And he said, well, I'd already warmed up in kitchens and closets. So, you know, it really threw my opponent off. But to me, it was no big deal.
Yeah.
You know, so I just handled it like I didn't expect this to happen. It's not a big deal. I can handle this. And he said, you know, he thought it was a huge benefit to him because he was able to deal with it and his opponent was not.
That's great. Okay, this next question. Some days I am just dragging mentally and physically. Some advise you to push through it. Some say to listen to your body and give yourself a break. Where do you fall on that? That's from Andrea M.
Before Ben and David give you the right, you know, the answer from the book, because I get asked this question a lot, right, all around the world. And two components to the answer. One is I can't think of one workout that I've done ever in my life that I regret. Not one. I can't think of one big problem I tackled that I never regret it, even if I went into it tired. And then secondly, the mindset for me is just sneakers on, right? Let's just get our sneakers on. We'll deal with the next step and the next step and the next step. So I'm sure Ben and David have a much better answer, but.
Well, I mean, so obviously that would be the one side of it, right? Is where, and I was just thinking about this as an entrepreneur and you're the business owner. Sometimes you just got to, I had a friend last weekend who wanted to go with their spouse and go do something fun, but they had a project that was due on Sunday night. It's like, no, it has to be done. I have to grind this out. But then there's sometimes when if you're burnt out, I mean, there's many, David could probably actually give the actual scientific reasons behind this, but if you take some time off and you go for a walk in the park or you take a nap, all of a sudden your mind just becomes fresh and the ideas pop up. Right. And so like the answer is, it's not an easy answer. Sometimes you're going to have to grind through it. There's a time limit to it. And sometimes you are better probably taking a day off or taking some time off and just kind of letting it marinate and having the solution come to you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What's the science behind that, David? Yeah. I wish I could cite it right now. I know it's there, but I can't quite cite it.
Well, I can say a theory behind that comes to my mind is there's a term called functional fixedness, or having a problem set. Like if you're racking your brain trying to solve a problem, if you don't take the proverbial step back, that you don't have the ability to even frame the problem in a different manner. You know, so it might be, wow, how am I going to make this car work? You know, I'm late. Right. You might step back and reframe the problem. How am I going to get where I need to be on time? So taking that step back often works. But again, on the flip side, sometimes folks use that as a way of excusing themselves from pushing through. I will reference in the book that we were able to interview Dr. Anna Lemke, who's quoted in the chapter, Push Through Pain and Pull Back the Reins. And she talks about one of the ways you know is that if your body is not improving with rest, you know, if you actually take some rest and you find that you're not better, then there may be something physiologically going on. Now, that, of course, is going to relate to athletics in a different kind of way than it would in a business or entrepreneur setting. But if you find that, like, you keep, you know, you continue in sleep debt and you're not getting better, it might be worth getting another set of eyes and ears to have you checked out.
One final question. My question is this. You know, if I wanted to get better at running, I could like look at a training program, I get on the track and start doing it. What about if I want to get better at being resilient or I want to get tougher mentally? Do you recommend, is there anything I could do to practice to exercise those muscles?
I feel like that one's easy. Joe will tell you about the toughness. I'll tell you about the resiliency. The resiliency is you got to put yourself in a situation where you're going to fail sometimes. You know, and that's something where people, like I said, if we go back to that self-awareness, some people won't even admit that they have a problem with resiliency. So they'll never put themselves in a situation where they can fail. And then when they're forced to be in that situation, because at some point life's going to throw you a curveball and you're going to fail. So when you're forced to be in that situation, now you don't know how to react. But if you would have put yourself in that situation voluntarily and you would have had to deal with some of those failures, all of a sudden you make yourself more resilient. And so, you know, I referenced the manager's meeting I had this morning as we talked about putting our athletes in situations where they're going to lose sometimes. I don't want them to win all the matches. I want them to be a match where they lose because I want some of their weaknesses exposed. I want them to have some adversity and I want them to have to be resilient. And that's something for sure that you can develop by putting yourself in that situation, but you got to shake the fear and you got to have enough self-awareness to know that is an area where I lack in. And in order, because I lack there, I'm going to put myself there. So.
Yeah. And what I would say, I tell everybody is we practice cooking, we practice math, we need to practice hard. And so for me, the quickest way is, you know, tough weather, cold water, darkness, lack of sleep. You go out, you know, I was on the farm in Vermont for 15 years growing a family and never looked at the weather once, all in an effort to build that toughness, to build those calluses. And it really works, and it works fast. I mean, you got to remember, we are the same species from, you know, 20, 30,000 years ago. It's just there's a bunch of layers that we have to peel away of softness and silk pajamas and all this nonsense. But they vanish really fast out in the cold.
Yeah, yeah, that's great. I love that. David, do you have any?
So the easy one there is start with one hard thing. If you tough, start with one hard thing. I tell my wife, I don't even need to be as tough as I used to be, because I used to compete in a cage for a living or wrestle, but I don't want to be a wimp anymore. So once in a while, I'll, you know, just write up some workout where I'm like, oh God, why am I doing this? This is gonna be terrible, you know? Or I'll see how hot I can get the steam room, right? Before I gotta quit, you know? Like, I gotta make sure I got it a little bit still. Yeah. So just pick a couple hard things and force yourself to do it.
That's great. David, do you have anything to add there?
Well, I'll say Ben and Joe really captured it. You can't get good at anything without engaging in deliberate practice in that thing. The one thing I'll add that makes it more likely that folks will get themselves to put themselves in a position to potentially fail and then have resolve to come back is a belief that you can get better through practice. If someone has a fixed mindset that they believe that failure is an indicator that they've reached their ceiling, then they're incentivized to avoid a situation where they might fail. But if you believe, you know, you have a growth mindset, you believe when you fail at something, that's told you what you're capable of right now, but you can improve upon that, then you're more likely to actually follow the advice that Joe and Ben are offering.
That's great. That's awesome. It reminds me of a quote I read from Steve Martin, who said when he first started playing the banjo, he was awful at it. He said it's extremely hard, but he just told himself in 10 years, this is going to be fun if I just keep at it. And worked out for him. All right, guys. Well, Joe DeSena, Ben Askren, David Sachs, the book is Extreme Balance. And as I said before, go to theentrepreneur.com/bookstore, put in the code EXTREME for 25% off. I read this book. It's awesome. If you like what you heard here, you're going to get a lot more. So thanks for listening. Thanks for sharing all your thoughts, guys. And yeah, I guess I'll have to see you again and talk to you about getting a cut of that second book if you do that social media part, right?
Absolutely.
Nice.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks a bunch.
All right. Thanks, guys.